She walks out and they talking, and I'm just standing, and I got this big grin on my face. And she sees me. She walks around the van and she looks and she says, Daddy? And just runs and jumps in my arm again. She said, you home? And I'm like, yeah. And so she had a father-daughter's dance that night. And
good timing.
So we went to that, man, and just to see her face. And she went and got every last one of her classmates and brought them over to me and was like, this is my dad. This is my daddy. And I was like, yeah, she has a dad. She said, I told y'all I had a dad.
Got another story of socioeconomic disadvantage, discernment between right and wrong, helping children, letting people down, destroying communities, and then coming back and making a difference. That's about all I can say about J.R. Troutman's story. A man who mentored children, coached kids, came up through the ranks, refused to get involved in street gang shenanigans until he ran into one situation that made him decide to just step over that line a little bit and ride it out until he finally ended up in prison, letting everyone know that what had been a facade. But what did he do with himself after that? That's what we find out here on the next TCast with J.R. Troutman. Check it out. I'm interested in obviously what kind of background and stuff you had, because apparently going into this, you had no criminal history or anything like that to speak of at all. But why don't we start talking about, let's just jump forward right into the bad stuff so that we can go back and try to paint the picture. I promise I won't linger on it, but it's kind of key to the storytelling, right? So we gotta know what we're looking at so that we can go back and understand better why and how it happened and what you're doing with it now. Is that cool?
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
Well, tell me about happened? the first time you even where you were and when you first started even considering it, and lead up into, you know, maybe how the thing fell apart.
Oh man. You know, it's kind of funny because, you know, you always heard about, you know, drug dealers and the bad things, you know, and for me, it never was an intention of mine to become that. I had an unfortunate situation happen to my mother that, you know, she struggled all her life throughout my childhood. And I think I was 21. She was at home and she pretty much lost all her teeth. And she had a couple and they were giving her a fit. And I sat there and I watched my mom cry, you know, night in, night out. My dad was an orthodontic technician. They were no longer together. So, at that time I was in between jobs. But I knew I had to do something for my mom. So I called my father and I asked him, you know, hey, mom is over here suffering. Has something to do with her mouth. Is there a dentist I can take her to? And he gave me a name of one and I took her and, well, I called and they told me the initial visit was going to be $200. I didn't have it. But I took my mom anyway. Mm-hmm. And I had some friends that I knew this is what they did. And my intentions were to go and try to make $200, talk them into allowing me to make $200. And when I did that, my friend, being a friend, was like, no, this is not for you. No, he gave me the money. So I went back, took care of my mom's bill, and then we got the workup of what it was going to cost. She had to have major surgery to have things removed.
Yeah, that's going to be way more than $200.
Yeah, so at that point, you know, I'm sitting here contemplating. And then ironically, the guy that I went to, who was hustling at the time, he had a misfortune with someone robbed him. And like I say, I just knew a lot of people in I knew a lot of people that did bad things. And mm-hmm. a lot of them sold drugs. And so I ended up middlemaning some stuff, and he was in need, and I knew somebody who had, and I linked them together, and I made a substantial amount of money in less than 30 minutes. And that was the beginning of my career as a drug dealer.
And so if you, how did you end up knowing these guys? You said you kind of knew a bunch of guys that were in the game.
I went to school with them. We went to high school together. We played high school football together. And, you know, we all had talent. And unfortunately, academics were a hindrance for us. You know, you can have all the talent in the world, but if you're not academically inclined to put yourself in a position to get your scholarships, to get an opportunity to get out of your environment, then you fall back to your environment. Mm-hmm. And that's what ended up happening to us. These guys before me. So that's how I knew them. And they used to pick on me because my grandmother stayed right across the street from that friend of mine. And I used to go visit her, and I would see them, you know, selling crack and all that stuff on the block. And I used to be like, yo, y'all need to be careful. You guys need to be careful. You know, that's illegal, right? You know, so
yeah.
So it was kind of ironic that I was that guy that was trying to tell them to be careful. And then I ended up falling back into that myself.
Right. But it does say a little more about you personally, because even they recognized you as having discernment in terms of what's right for you and what's wrong for you. And at some point you end up crossing that line of your own that you made, but at least that was a recognizable line. And I assume this was it a poor neighborhood, or what were the circumstances?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Yeah, it was a low income neighborhood. Was known for drug trafficking, murders, you name it, prostitution. I mean, everything mm-hmm. was in that neighborhood.
Okay.
And at that time, you know, our parents used to warn us, you know, I don't want you hanging here, hanging out, you know, especially late at night, or good things never happen up there. You know, just try to stay away from it.
Right. And how difficult was it for, what do you think was the difference between you and the guys that did kind of fall into that? What do you think a personality trait is that goes right into it as opposed to having to really consider it or never touching it? I mean, what are some of the things that you noticed about them that made you realize that they're just going to jump straight in? Because you said they were athletes and stuff too, so they obviously had some other talents. Not like they had no choices, right?
Yeah. You know, for a while, we kind of lost contact because the guy actually did go to college. He went to a junior college, but he ended up flunking out, and he ended up coming back home. And I didn't realize it at the time, but my grandmother, she was staying on the front side of him. And then they came in and condemned those homes that she was living in. So she had to move, and she moved directly behind him and with his mom. And I would see him, and I never knew he was back home. So actually, I ran into him, you know, by visiting my grandmother and realizing, you know, just where he was living, and he was back, and me seeing what he was doing. So that's when I first knew or found out that, you know, he was selling dope, I mean, drugs. So the difference is, you know, we all came from broken homes. His dad was never around at all. It was his mom always, even in high school, you know, we never had our fathers actively involved in our lives. My dad was well off, but, you know, he made some choices that he felt he needed to make. And it didn't include my sister and I. Him and my mom had a very bad relationship. So it was strained. So there was no communication. I mean, he paid child support, but I mean, that wasn't doing anything. So when we say the struggle is real, when you're dealing with, especially this is like in early 90s, you know, things for us were bad because you had the influx of drugs running rampant through our community. And you're seeing these guys, you know, rolling around in these cars with the gold chains. You know, back then it was the yellow gold chains and yeah. stuff like that. So, but for me, I never gravitated to that. So now I can't speak for the other guys if that's what, you know, they wanted to do or how he really got involved. But I just know for me, it was never about that. The unfortunate situation for me was that, you know, I got there by trying to help my mother, and the money was just so good that, you know, I just stuck in there. You know?
Yeah. And that was ultimately the motivation, is that you needed money on the quick and decided to just kind of sacrifice your decision, your typical decision making, in lieu of getting your mom help. She had no other way. You didn't have any other family or friends to leverage. The friends that you did leverage are now letting you in the game. And you said you're middling. So for an audience of mine that may or may not know what that is, you're providing an opportunity for a buyer and a seller to make their exchange. It's not like you're a facilitator, right? You're facilitating a deal. Hey, I know this guy that needs something. And for you, I know this guy that's got something. Is that how you ended up taking your position there in terms of the game? Is that what you did the whole time? Kind of a middleman, middling different things? And for how long did you do that?
Yeah, actually, it came out to be that guy, how it was presented to me was like, you know, somebody broke into my place. They stole whatever he had. And he came to me and said, I was looking for half an ounce, which is 14 grams. And
hard.
Another friend of his was looking for a quarter, which is another 7 grams. So there's 28 grams in an ounce. So I go to my friend. I said, let me make a phone call. At this time, that's when you had pages. So I paged my guy. We played basketball together. I was a pretty good athlete. So we played basketball together. And I was in community college, and that's how I met this guy. And so I told him I needed to talk to him, because you never talk over the phone. Mm-hmm. So I go to his house. I tell him what's going on. And mind you, at this time, prices for an ounce was $1,400. Okay. And this guy was like, man, I really don't feel comfortable, you know, with you getting involved in this, you know. You got talent. You should be doing this. I said, yeah, but this is my friend. You know, he helped me out when I was in the jam. I really need to try to help him. So he said, okay, this is what I'll do for you. He said, I'll give you this ounce, which is 28 grams. I had no clue what that was, you know. And I said, well, he said he needed a half an ounce and a quarter ounce, which is 14 grams. I mean, 21 grams total.
Right.
So he ended up splitting the ounce up for me into a half and two quarters. So he said, if you can bring this back to me in 24 hours, I will only charge you $700. So I said, wow, okay.
Because this is crack, right? That's why you got that margin on it, right? You talking about crack?
No, this is, yeah, this is crack, yeah.
Okay.
So I was like, wow, okay. And I remember the guy telling me, my friend was like, you know, I paid $700 for the half and, you know, $350. So an ounce is going for $1,400. So that's $700 and $350. So that's $1,050. So, and I still had a quarter left. So in that deal, I had already made an extra $350 and gave him his $700. So, so when I go to see my friend, I show him what I had, and he's like, what are you going to do with that other quarter? I said, I have no clue. So he said, give it to me. I'll be back in an hour, 2 hours. Well, he came back in an hour. And so I had went and took the guy the money. He was like, you done already? And I was like, yeah. So the guy came back in an hour with the other 350. So that was all profit for me. So I just made $700 in less than 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And this guy was moving major weight, my friend. So he and I, after seeing that, kind of formed a partnership. So my guy would give it to me and I would give it to him and he would work it and bring me back the money. So from that point, I kind of became the, as people call it today, the plug. And without even intending to, not even knowing that's what I was doing, I will say this. At no point of my entire life that I got involved in the game did I ever want to be the man. I never wanted to be that guy that, you know, it's just, you know, this is who you go to. Mm-hmm. You know, I always kept my circle small. I always tried to make the necessary arrangements and preparation mentally to know if something ever went wrong, I would know where it came from.
And that probably made you more valuable to them too, because you're not going to try to step on somebody's game. You know your role, you're keeping your circles tight. I mean, that's, you're the perfect guy for that gig.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing I hate about the most, and it took me a while, and I might be jumping ahead a little bit, but, you know, I never realized how I was damaging my community. And that's the thing that disappointed me the most. Once I got in trouble, that's the first thing that hit me, is that you're doing damage to your community.
Yeah.
Even though I didn't live in my community any longer, I was doing damage.
Right. And a lot of that's maturity too, right? I mean, you were how old? You said 21?
Yeah, I was 21 when I started, but I was 42 when I went to prison.
Well, I mean, it's, some of it's just perspective. Like I said, a lot of people just get stuck inside of their motivation and they don't think outside the box in terms of how it's affecting other people. I think that's kind of common in a lot of stages of life, particularly with young people, though, who are most of the time are the ones that are they're dealing in gang life and start slinging and stuff, because otherwise, you know, by the time you get older, you're either not around anymore or you're locked up somewhere, right?
Right.
Well, this is a really interesting perspective. Is there anything that triggered that? I mean, how did you come to realize how you impacted your community by doing that? What epiphany hit you?
Well, let's put it this way. I need to mention this also. I have a love for kids. I've always, when I was a kid and not having that father, I played little league, rec football, and there were people, men, white men, that came in and played that father role for me. They taught me a lot. I was able to go outside of my neighborhood and see other things. It's a lot of people that don't get a chance to go outside of their neighborhood. They're just stuck. You know, and if you don't have that force of someone to come in and show you something different, then you have tunnel vision. Your mind never gets outside the box. So for me, I was able to see a lot of things, different neighborhoods, different geographical areas. And I always remember telling myself at some point in my life, this is where I would like to be. So it gave me an opportunity to focus on other things and not just the things that I was going through. So,
kind of see outside of yourself, kind of.
Yeah. And my sister, she had two kids at the age of 14 and 15. So I had my little nephews in the house. My mom was struggling. We all were struggling. So that's another thing that kept me in the game. I was taking care of everybody. You know, I took care of kids around the neighborhood. I got involved in coaching like summer league teams. That's the way I was giving back. My money, the money that I made, and I made a lot of money. I'll be honest with you. A lot of money has come through my hands, but it never stayed because I was always doing for other people. That doesn't justify what I did. I don't want people to think that's what I'm trying to do, but that's what it was for me. So knowing that, I still had an inkling of, I know what's right and I know what's wrong. And I made guidelines, like it was certain individuals that I would never sell to. It was certain individuals that I would never let around. My clique that I hung out with. And like I said, my clique was small. But it was putting up boundaries so I wouldn't allow people who were close to me that I was doing for to gravitate to what I was doing. I never wanted any of my family members to get involved with what I was doing. I never wanted any of the kids that I mentored or that I coached to get into that. And the hindsight behind the whole thing is I didn't practice what I preached, you know?
Right.
And it ended up biting me in the butt.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't discount where your heart is, but obviously, logically, when things are working, it's kind of hard to just back out. Like you said, you're making lots of money. And you have opportunities to mentor kids and everything else, but you're not really thinking outside of, again, you're still working inside your box, right?
Yeah.
And so how long did you end up doing this? I mean, obviously you ended up coaching, you graduated high school, you play ball and you start coaching. How long were you actually involved in the game while you're doing all this stuff? That entire time?
Well, man.
I mean, I don't mean to ask that in an incriminating way, because I know. Look, you've done your time and it's done. Let's just say, kind of, how long were you generally involved? You know, was it that entire 20-year period, or was it?
I want to say often it was, and it wasn't always cocaine or crack. I want to say I might have been in the game 22 years.
Okay, so you actually are pretty dang lucky, right? I mean,
Oh yeah. Man, listen, I had run-ins with officers before that I just knew they had me, and by the grace of God, you know, I never got caught. You know, I'm just saying, man, God was looking out for me. I've been robbed, shot at, gunpoint, you know. I'm only here because of His grace and His mercy. You know, I do know that.
And you're obviously, I want to back up before I come back to this point, because I think that your fortune is something that we could talk about, how you're taking this forward. But
okay,
let's give a little detail about how it actually fell apart, because obviously that has to be one of the more impactful parts of this whole story, right? Is when it finally crashed. Tell me a little bit about what was going on and what you experienced during that.
You know, it got to the point that I became obsessed with the money, and there was no reason for me to do that. I always worked. I had pretty good jobs. But I just never felt like I had enough money. When you were in my position where you just had abundance of product available to you and you knew that you could move it. And you knew that if I went out and I spent, say, $6,000-$7,000, I knew that I could always make that right back. So, I became frivolous with money. Like I say, if you knew me, if you ever needed anything, it was nothing for me to say, yo, here's $500, here's $1,000. Some of the money I got back, some I didn't, but it didn't matter to me because I knew I could make it. So I sit here and I say, twenty 22 years that for at least 15 of those years, I shouldn't have been selling drugs. I was fortunate enough to work my way into a FedEx home delivery contract, becoming a FedEx home delivery contractor. Now, I never used that to hustle my drugs. I never did that. But, I mean, I took over for this guy. And as a subcontractor, when I took over, the business was making $62,000. In 3 years, I grew from $62,000 to $115,000.
That's great money. That,
say that again.
That's great money. Yeah, it's legit. You're legit now, right?
And you know, but I also, in that job, I also had a lot of expenses. You have an employees, you have to pay to go to work in that business because you got to purchase fuel for trucks for day, every day. I mean, it was just a lot. And I never actually had time to sit down and look at the business model. Even though I was growing it, I never had a chance to sit down and look at it to see actually what I was making, you know? Right. And when I say I sold the route in 2011, and at that time it was doing $150,000 a year, and I sold it for $70,000. And I never even took the time out to realize, dude, you got serious cash coming through your hand legally, you know?
Right.
But the one thing I did learn, you know, going through this, that the trick is, you know, don't mean to get religious on you or anything, but the devil works in mysterious ways too, because he always makes us feel like what we have is never enough. And when in the hustle game, when you get that mentality, that's when you start living on the edge. That's when things potentially start falling apart and unraveling.
And for me, makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
And for me, I saw it, but I didn't see it. And my daughter's mother, man, I put her in a bad situation, and that's when I realized, after I got in trouble, the bad situation I put it in is that I made the choice to continue to sell drugs when I didn't have to, and she didn't know about it until I got arrested. And when I got arrested, we weren't together. And that's when it hit me. It was like, dude, you just lost everything. You know? And so that's, I mean, yeah, 22 years and I'm fortunate to still be here. I'm fortunate to be alive and I'm fortunate to be free. So, 22 years.
Wow, that's a crazy story. And the fact that you could hide it speaks to how well and how subtly you worked through it. But it is interesting to try to understand how it was that you still lacked the full perspective because of that hunger. I can see where the drive to constantly make more, that's really the machine that you know that you can keep going in. So it keeps your rational thought process from taking over, because you would have still, you know, even with your company, would have had to sacrifice quite a bit to take that pay cut, but would have been the safest time to do that, I'm sure. And how did this impact the kids that you were working with? Not necessarily, or even the ones that you had mentored in the past. I mean, how did you actually handle that? I mean, this came out in the news. Everybody made a big deal of the fact that you were an assistant coach. And because it obviously, if you were around kids, again, that perception, just putting that out there, is more sensationalized, right? But it's also serious. And you being a mentor couldn't understand where, if it was your kid, you would be concerned about that situation. So how did you handle that? Did you have any of the kids reach out, or did you reach out to any of the parents or anything like that at any given time?
Yeah, man. You know, when that thing happened, like you said, yeah, it was in the news later. And a lot, I'm pretty well known in the town that I'm in. And I think a lot of people knew what my lifestyle was as far as, you know, hustling. But at that time, I switched the game from cocaine to weed, marijuana. And a lot of my kids, like I said, when I was coaching high school, you know, I had a lot of connections that helped me with my kids that I coached. Because I had kids that were following the same footsteps that I did at a young age. Mm-hmm. And now I have people that will be on the block that would call me and say, hey, man, one of your players up here on the corner selling. So I would go intervene, pick them up, chastise them, get them to school. And there's a lot of kids, man, that just was like, that drew to me because I could relate to them. I could relate to their home life. I can relate to not having things and their family struggling. And they had no clue what I was doing. None whatsoever. Only thing they knew was, damn, Coach Troutman, he cares about us. You know, it's not just I'm an athlete. He's wondering what's going on at home. Mm-hmm. You know, it was nothing for me on Christmas. And I know kids were struggling and parents were struggling. It was nothing for me to, you know, buy gifts and, you know, play Santa Claus a little bit to kids and give them clothes, necessities and things that they needed. And when this thing happened to me, a lot of the kids, man, even the parents was like, that's not the Coach Troutman we know. When things happened, they went to my school and tried to go in and interview the principal and the kids at the school. And the principal was like, no, we're not going to allow y'all to do that. You know, we don't know what's going on. Yes, we heard that Coach Troutman got in trouble, but that's all we're going to say. No, he said, well, I will tell you this. That's not the Coach Troutman we know. And we just have to wait to see, you know, how everything plays out. I did get a phone call because I was actually at the barbershop getting a haircut at this time when it happened. And my head coach called me and was like, Coach, did you get in trouble over the weekend? I said, Coach, I really can't talk about it. And he was like, well, I'm just letting you know, Fox 8 News here in our local area just left the school and they're trying to interview kids. And the principal ran them off the campus.
Yeah.
And as soon as he said that, and my barber's cutting my hair, it's breaking news that comes across the TV. There's my picture. There's my story. So now it's out there. And I'm just like, wow. And next thing you know, my phone just started blowing up. And it was my kids. It was the kids that I was coached. And they was like, Coach, we don't believe that about you. You know, we love you. You know, we support you. We know this ain't you. And I'm just sitting there and I'm just like, you know what? I appreciate that. But let me change my number. I called and changed my phone number because I didn't want to put anybody in a peculiar situation, reaching out to me, not knowing everything that was going on, you know, not knowing what the investigation was, because it took me a while before I got the gist of how everything happened.
And it's had to be impactful to hear from your kids. I mean, obviously, you know, kind of end up undoing a lot of the stuff that you did. And again, you've already acknowledged that you feel like you've impacted the neighborhood and in your community. And that's one of the ways that it happens, even though you're not trying to do that. I mean, you see this happen a lot. And that's why I'm so curious about how it manifests in your particular situation, because I know how meaningful it is. That's got to be as bad as getting sent to prison, is knowing that the kids that you cared about and had mentored to that level just refused to believe it. I know how tough that's got to be.
Yeah, I mean, it is. But, you know, my cousin at that time was a attorney that was running for judge. A friend of mine who was a childhood friend of mine that I used as my attorney, they both called me and said, listen, man, because I sheltered in place, dude. When that happened, man, I was just like, I was so low. I mean, it was just like, no, let me back up. Two things. I was at my lowest point, but I was so relieved that it finally happened. I think.
Interesting.
By it happening, a weight was lifted off my back, because I remember, man, I was just like sleeping with my doors unlocked. It was like, okay, I know one day they just gonna come in. So I'm gonna leave the door unlocked. That way they don't have to kick the door down if they try to open the door, you know, and that's crazy. That's a crazy mm-hmm. thought, but that's how I felt. I was just like, you know, every night I would go to bed. It wasn't the fact I was worried that somebody robbed me or somebody come in and try to kill me. Because I was never that type of dude. I never crossed people. But it was just the fear factor of I was getting tired. My family had left. And, you know, it was just me. And I was just like, man, I'm just tired. I'm going out, I'm partying, I'm drinking all times of the night, coming home, going to work. And it became a routine that was just beating me down. And when that happened, man, I really was like, man, okay, where do I go from here? But I was embarrassed. I stayed in the house, say maybe for a good 2 months. Saw all the shades drawn down and lost the job, because the guy that I sold my route to, I was running the business for him. So when FedEx saw that, it was like, yo, he's no longer allowed on the facility, on the premises. He can't be involved. He can't do anything for you. And so, you know.
This is the time. I assume you're bonded out at this point, right?
Yeah. I bonded out the same
day. Okay.
I probably would only been down there for maybe about an hour. The bondsmen, you know, they know who I was. And they knew I wasn't your typical drug dealer. I wasn't that guy that tote guns and that guy that, you know, just out here just selling dope to the world. And they gave me a decent bond. I was charged with 2 counts of trafficking and maintaining a vehicle dwelling. Had never been in trouble except for second degree trespassing, something that was dismissed or something that happened years ago at a Waffle House. But the guy was like, look, you know, I'm not gonna put your paperwork in where the newspaper comes in at certain times of the night trying to see who got arrested. I'm not gonna do that. We know you're not a bad guy. They were like, the detective was like, you know, we could take your vehicles and all that stuff, but we know you're not that type of guy. So he was just like, man, just make sure you get yourself a good lawyer. And I was like, okay. So I bonded out. I got caught in the shift change. So I was there a little longer than I would have been had that not happened, but because my bondsman was downtown before I got downtown. And the thing that I found, you know, like I said, man, when I look back on this, and I know I'm all over the place, but when I look back on it, man, I see God's hand in everything. Because normally when someone gets busted like that, you know, they take you downtown, they interrogate you, they do, you know, threaten you with all types of stuff. When they caught me, I didn't give them any issues. I let them come back to my house and search. They didn't find anything else. Guy was like, look, man, you know, I know you're a good dude. Took me downtown, processed me. He asked me, he was like, you know, the person that gave us you, you know, we can make this go away by, you know, you giving us what you got, what we caught you with or more. I said, dude, listen, it's not even that type of party. You know, I can't give you who gave you me. It was nothing to discuss. One of the things people don't understand the rules you'll learn that we learned early on. The rules of the game is too, like you said earlier. If you stay in the game long enough, two things are going to happen to you. Either you're going to end up dying in the streets or you're going to prison. It ain't if, I mean, it's not going to happen. It's if, when it happens. And for me, that's what happened to me. You know, I never told on anybody. I never talked to the police about anybody. You know, when it was time for me to, you know, go in and handle my business, you know, I went for a discovery motion and suppression motion. And they both got denied. So I was not able to face my accuser. And I know a lot of people say you have a right to face your accuser. That is not true. That's to the discretion of the judge. So if you go for a suppression motion and a discovery motion and the judge denies your discovery motion because they deem that informant to be credible and they want to protect his identity, then they don't disclose who he is.
Right.
But, you know, for me, I always said if I ever got in trouble, I would know where it came from. And so it was just like a bad nightmare coming to an end. But I still had a lot more to go through before I got to the end of it to get to the good side of where I am now.
Yeah. Yeah. And so having that weight lifted off your shoulders and then dealing with the fact that you had a penance to pay and with the psychological effects of knowing that you let a bunch of people down in your community and everything else, you did your time, you got out. Now, tell me a little bit about like what you're doing now and how you leverage this experience to better not only yourself, but the people around you. Because now that you're on the straight and narrow, you kind of have some kind of credibility too, to speak from experience. And people, and unless you dive back in, you know, this is like a recovered addict talking to an addict. You know, there's a level of appreciation for somebody who's been through that, both sides. So what do you do with yourself now, and how are you leveraging that experience moving forward?
First off, I had to learn about myself. When I got sentenced to 35 to 42 months, I was facing 6 to 10. I took a plea of 35 to 42 months. I was guilty. I have to say this. I was guilty. Now, how they went about it, was a legal stop, search, and seizure. But of course, a lot of things transpired in those hearings that was false. But it opened my eyes. It really opened my eyes to how the system works, and the things people are willing to go to get a conviction. But I had to accept the responsibility. Hey, dude, if you didn't have the damn drugs, you wouldn't be in that position for you to be in the position that you're in. So with that, I was like, hey, let me go do this time. The one thing the judge told me, he was like, listen, because I tried to put it off. Because my mom was having surgery, and I was like, this was on like a Thursday. The hearing ended on a Wednesday. I had to come back for sentencing on a Thursday morning. And we petitioned to the court, to the judge, if I could, have to Monday turn myself in. My mom's having surgery. And the judge said to me, he's like, listen, your mom know you love her, but I think it's more important for you to get your sentence started today so you can get back out here and continue to give back to the kids the way you have been doing. Unfortunately for you, you made a bad mistake. And a choice, and with those mistakes and choices come consequences. But I'm pretty sure after you do your time, you could come back and be a valuable member of society and continue to help the kids. So with that being said, I went into prison. I went in and I was just like, I was lost. didn't think I was going to prison, but I got sentenced to prison. And I formed a relationship with my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, and God. And the one thing I asked him was to reveal me to myself. And when he did that, that was an eye-opening experience, because there was a lot of stuff about me that was screwed up, and there was a lot of stuff about me I didn't like. So I had to get rid of it. And I knew a lot of people who went to prison, and they let the time do them, not them doing the time. So I said, okay, I'm going to go in here. I'm going to learn everything I can. I'm going to take every course I can. But I never did anything by myself. It was that I had a high power that guided me through this life-changing experience. And, you know, the one thing I want to say is, like, the home life, my daughter's grandparents, I hurt them tremendously. And the look of disappointment on their faces when they found out what I did would never leave my mind. And that was gut-wrenching. But while I was gone, now we're back together. So my fiance's mom wrote me, I can't even tell you how many times, encouraging me. We built a relationship, you know. She sent me books, things that I needed. You know, it was never money. I never asked them for money or anything like that, but just cards, you know, making sure that, you know, I was getting positivity from the outside world. I thought I would never hear from these people ever again. I thought they wrote me off and they were done with me. But I started making life changes and I started taking these courses, and I got to a facility about 18 months into my sentence. I got to a facility called Forsyth Correctional Facility, and it was ran by a prison ministry, really, the camp was. And they did so much for the inmates, and they were about family. They were about making a father who's been removed from the home feel like he was still part of the family, of the dynamic. Even though I was absent, they made sure that, you know, I was able to provide for my daughter for Christmas. They made sure that, you know, spiritually we was being fed by people from the outside that came in and donated their time. They even bought in programs. Covey, the seven habits of highly effective people.
Yeah, Stephen Covey, I think.
Yeah, they bought that course in. I took that. You know, that right there was an eye opener in itself, man. I was just like, I was blown away by that. I was like, wow, you know, if I could implement these things into my life and how I think, maybe I can start patching up a relationship that I damaged with my daughter's mother. You know, so I started working towards that. And through that, man, my daughter, my fiance, Sarah, she was faithful in bringing my daughter to visit. And that was very hard. Because, and I know them all, again, I know them all over the place, but it's things I can't go without mentioning. It took me 64 days for me to see my daughter for the very first time after I left. And that was just so hard. And when she saw me for the first time, you know, it's protocols in prison when you have visitations and stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, my daughter didn't care about that. She snatched her hand out of mom's hand and came running and jumped in my arms. And daddy, 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 daddy. And I started feeling on my face like, daddy, is that you? Is this really you? And you know, that broke my heart. And we had a good visit. And when they left, something just said, call. So I called, and her mom answered the phone, and I just heard the screaming in the background. And I was like, yo, what's going on? I said, where y'all at? She was like, we still in the parking lot. She wants you. She does not want to leave, and she will not stop crying. And I almost told her, don't bring her back to see me. You know, because I never wanted to put my child through that. I never wanted to put anybody through that, but I was so selfish that my actions actually did that.
Yeah. And obviously, how is your relationship now? I mean, obviously, she kept coming to visit and gained a better understanding of where you were and your point in that life. And I think the visitation was probably healthy for her, too, even though it seemed unhealthy at first. I mean, it's part of reality, right? So how are you guys now?
You're talking about me and my daughter or me and my mom?
Yeah, either one, but the daughter in particular who had a hard time really understanding it, and you were tempted to even, you know, tell her not to come back. She obviously came back and gained a better understanding and maintained a relationship, right?
Yeah. The facility, Forsyth Correctional Facility that I was at, like I told you, it was run by the prison ministry. It was only like 30 minutes from the house. So by me going through all these classes and stuff, we were able to invite one person to come share, like when we graduated from a certain class, they were able to come in and be our guest. So she actually got to see everything that I was doing, the transformation, the work I was putting in, the courses I was taking, and listen to other people talk about my accomplishments through those programs. But one of the best things they offered, man, they offered counseling, couples counseling. And you know, the pastor over there, his name was David Stillwell. Man, he was just awesome. You know, he brought us in. You know, we did this, twice a month. We sit down for an hour and have counseling. You know, we weren't together, but it was about us connecting and what her expectations of me when I was released. And, you know, if there was an opportunity for us to put things back together. So we were able to share a lot. She shared with me the hurt that I caused her, the pain. And her hesitancy of wanting to try to see if we could put our family back together again. And I was so grateful that she was even willing to be open to that idea. You know, you got guys who go to prison and when you come home, they don't want to have anything to do with you, you know, keep your kids from you and everything. But fortunately for me, you know, and that wasn't the case. Now, she was afraid of what her parents would think. And when I got out, it was on a Friday. It was February 26, 2016. My daughter, she was in first grade. And her friends used to pick on her. Like, you don't have a dad. And she was like, I do have a dad. They were like, well, how come he never comes around? And she never told anybody where I was at. And this particular day, she knew I was getting out that weekend, but she didn't know what day. So this particular day, I get out. My mom picks me up. My fiance picks me up. And we, you know, I wanted to do like the military guys, you know. You go in and you surprise the kid in classroom. And she was like, nah, we don't want to do that because, you know, here come questions. And
right.
So she said, let me go in and get her. You just wait here and hide behind. So we parked beside this van. She's like, you just hide right here behind the van. And I'm just going to go get her. We just walk out and just casual conversation. And so she walks out. I think she may have it on video too still. So she walks out and they're talking and I'm just standing there. And I got this big grin on my face. And she sees me. She walks around the van and she looks and she says, Daddy? And just runs and jumps in my arm again. She said, you home? And I'm like, yeah. And so she had a father-daughter's dance that night. And
good timing.
So we went to that, man, and just to see her face. And she went and got every last one of her classmates and brought them over to me and was like, this is my dad. this is my daddy. And I was like, yeah, she has a dad. She said, I told y'all I had a dad. And them kids were just like, uh-oh, okay. And that made her night, man. I mean, we did a dance together, man. And just to see the joy and the pride on her face, man, just to know that I was home. And I made a promise to her. And, you know, I know they say you're never supposed to make promises, but I made a promise that I would never leave her again. Not by doing anything illegal or anything like that.
Right.
You know.
Well, that's a worthy promise. I mean, it keeps you accountable, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, she was mad at me for a long time. You know, she was like, Dad, you know, you left me for 3 years. And did you learn your lesson? Will you ever do anything else? I said, Babe, no, I learned my lesson. And, you know, that's the difference. You go to prison. Some people go to prison and they just continue to do the same thing. You know, they go in there and they just move the same. They're just not outside the gates moving. They inside the gates, but they're doing the same thing. I tried to change a lot of things about me, habits, and I took notice. I spent a lot of time reading, a lot of time in the Word of Christ, and I started learning principles, Proverbs, Book of Proverbs, man, it's a great guide to just living life, you know, life principles. And I try to instill those even to this day. Now, being out here, I'll tell you, being back out here in the world, you know, before everything stops, I had all the time in the world to do what I wanted to do as far as mentally get myself prepared. But no matter how much you prepare yourself on the inside, it's still an everyday struggle when you come outside those gates and you got all this temptation out here to you. I was lucky. Like I said, her parents, man, came back around. We got a hell of a relationship, man.
That's awesome.
You know, we would have been married, but COVID screwed us up. So we're still trying to put that date together. But the relationship in itself, man, that woman loves me. I love her. We love our child. I'm actually, you know, when I came home work-wise, it was a struggle. I knew a lot of people. I thought I could come out and, you know, depend on some people to give me some employment, but it didn't quite go that way. Buddy of mine did employ me for a little while. Then I went back and got my CDLs and started driving school buses. Those were the only people that would take a chance on me. And now I'm driving semis. I don't pull freight, but I transport trucks all over the country. Actually, I just got back from a trip. Been gone a week and a half. I drove from Virginia to Indiana, from Indiana to Pacific Washington, from Tacoma, Washington, Phoenix, and I flew in last night. So I'm blessed. I've been able to see all 47 states. The only one I haven't been able to see yet is North Dakota. But you know, I've truly been blessed. I'm back making grossing over $100,000 a year for the last 3 years. It hasn't been easy, but you know, I can go to sleep at night. I don't have to look over my shoulder. You know, I don't have to worry about nobody kicking in my door, you know, trying to come look for me, talking about you wanted in a drug investigation and all that stuff. So life has been great. I'm very happy where I am. I've heard from my former kids. You know, I used to coach Keenan Allen that plays for the Chargers. Mm-hmm. You know, he's doing well, and you know, I've talked to him, and he's encouraged. You know, he's encouraging me. Never look down on me.
That's great. You know, that's great to know.
Yeah, it's a good feeling when you know you've done work, and even though you screwed up, you've helped other people, and people realize that, and they tell you that constantly.
And part of this. I mean, part of my purpose too is to recognize that people will fall down, and you have to give a little grace, because all of us take turns taking a dive somewhere in some way. It manifests in different ways. Some people will get away with things for longer, but all of us have a natural tendency to just throw out judgment. And so the fact that you've recovered for yourself, you have accountability to your family, your family has taken a great leap of faith in welcoming you in, and you've taken it upon yourself to stay on the straight and narrow and reestablish yourself, then I think that's a model for a lot of people. And I guess at your core, I think that's what people see in you, which is why I think you have people like Keenan who are still encouraging you and to keep your head up, you know. And that's what I'm trying to put out there too, because I think you have a unique story, and I love success stories, and nobody likes to see somebody fall. Some people do, but the people that watch this podcast aren't interested in that as much as learning from the people who've fallen and how they get back up, or maybe understanding why someone could fall into something like that. And that's what I found unique about your story, is that you seem to be not the person that ended up in prison, because you had the right kind of life alignment and the right kind of discernment to decide, hey, this is not for me. And even your drug slinging brethren at the beginning knew that too. It's like, man, this isn't your game. So people make choices like that that affect other people. So it's important to know that. And the fact that you recognized that and made your 180 degree turn has been remarkable. I'm really, really impressed with you. And, you know, I definitely appreciate you sharing your story with others too. I think it'll help a lot of people.
Yeah, appreciate it. You know, one thing I want to say, if you got people listening to your podcast, man, and they're convicted felons, you know, we're always going to be an outcast. I don't care how old that felon is. You're always going to be considered a part of the caste system, you know, the new new second class citizen per se. But don't let that stop you. You know, one of the most lucrative businesses out there for anyone with a felony is trucking. It's so much opportunity. And I'm a hustler by heart. I will say that. So I take those same principles and I go out here and I apply to something that's very legal. I don't try to get slick and, you know, while I'm driving this truck, I try to transport something. Nah. You know, it was a saying, and I don't know, you've probably heard this. You're probably old enough that you've heard this. Remember my parents used to say, y'all think money grow on trees?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
Well, in the business that I do, it does. I can look at a board and plan things, and I see a ballpark figure of what something is paying because I bid on my loads. But I have a target of making anywhere between $1,500 to $3,500 a week. And it's very attainable and it's legal. I just run like hell on trucks, but it's legal. And man, that feeling, that rush, you know, that, hey, I'm doing this legally. And my family can be proud of me and say, hey, he's working hard. You know, it's not easy. I work hard. And believe it or not, even in a drug game, it's not easy. It's man, you got to have skills, dude.
Yeah.
Supply and demand, you know. You got to be able to say, stay under the radar. You know, I mean, it's just things that you probably don't even think about that you're doing, that transferable skills that go to employment. And just finding the right niche. And, you know, I encourage people, you know, never be afraid to start your own business. You know, because when a lot of people are going to tell you no, but you're not going to tell yourself no if it's something that's right, if it's something that can help you and help put you and your family in a position where, you know, you're not struggling. I'm very blessed. My family's very blessed. We have a great home. I lost everything and had to start over. But, you know, where I am right now is very much a success story. But I never did anything by myself. It was God first, strong support system second. And, you know, just knowing that where you've been, what you've been through, and not being willing to go back and sacrifice that for being selfish. You know, being selflessness over selfishness.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great one. You look outside of yourself and live to serve others. It it takes a, on a new direction completely in the way you handle your business. So it's great lessons to learn from you, Mr. Troutman. And I'll be back in touch with you. I can almost assure you that, because I have some other questions that maybe we can squeeze in some other little special, because I mean, yeah, there's so many little aspects of this experience that I think are something we can all learn from. But I'm blessed to have had you on the show, and I appreciate your time, and I look forward to talking to you again really soon, brother.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. And now I know your podcast. I'll be checking you out.
Come on, bring it.
And if you need me for anything, man, anything, please don't hesitate to reach out.
Keep on keeping on the golden age caffeine. It's some side wind you're on. Another situation. See the road from the stripes with the lights coming on. Freedom came upon a catastrophic dream. Another dark page to turn. Another situation. They can't have your heart to find. To pursue once has just another time. And every wish ain't hope till the soul is mine. Keep your muse on loop till your angel cries. A sunlit path you're on, obscure majestic trees. Way to turn, just take a new direction. See the road from the side, your old strides were ever long. Free to think about the way it's supposed to be. It's another dark page to turn, it's another situation.